From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the story of best friends growing up in Hell's Kitchen. Lorenzo Carcaterra's new book, Sleepers, is about the three friends he grew up with. A childish prank landed them in a reformatory, and during that hellish year, they were beaten and abused. Two of the boys grew up to become mob hitmen, and later they took the law into their own hands and murdered one of the reformatory guards who had abused them. And book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Last House, the final book in a trilogy of writings by M.F.K. Fisher, published after her death. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Federal Reserve is moving to cut short-term interest rates. It's the first such effort in nearly 3 years. The cut is a quarter of a point. It means that the federal funds rate will drop to 5.75%. The federal funds rate is the rate that banks charge each other for loans, but it has a ricochet effect on loans that affect consumers. Already, Bank One Corporation of Ohio has lowered its prime rate to 8.75%. Bank One is the nation's eighth-largest bank. Senator John Glenn is the most unique campaign debt in U.S. history. Now, 11 years after his 1984 presidential campaign, he's trying to settle it. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
Glenn's campaign committee owes banks and businesses $3.3 million. That's about the same amount it owed more than a decade ago. More than $1 million worth of payments have not made a dent in the total because the interest keeps piling up. So now Glenn is trying to make the red ink disappear once and for all. He's throwing in $300,000 of his own money. He's giving up trying to raise outside funds. He says, after all, it's hard to raise money for a campaign he lost 11 years ago. And he's writing his business creditors with an offer. Companies that are owed more than $1,000 are being asked to cancel the debt after accepting $1,000 plus 10% of the balance. A Glenn spokesman hopes the settlements can be reached by the end of the year. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
An Israeli cabinet minister says there is no reason to fear a Palestinian state as long as it will live in peace with Israel. The statement comes as Israel and the PLO are trying to finalize the next stage of their agreement for expanding Palestinian self-rule. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Housing Minister Binyamin Ben-Eliezer told Israel Television that the Israel-PLO agreement means the end of the era of Israeli occupation and that the Palestinians must decide what kind of coexistence they will have with Israel. But he also said that Israel cannot withdraw from the West Bank completely and will retain areas around Jerusalem where tens of thousands of Jewish settlers live. Ben-Eliezer's statements came 2 days after Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and PLO leader Yasser Arafat agreed to complete negotiations on the next stage of their agreement by July 25th. The deal calls for a three-stage Israeli troop pullout from most of the West Bank over 2 years and Palestinian elections by the end of the year. Arafat also promised to amend the Palestine National Covenant, which calls for the destruction of Israel. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The deadly mall collapse in Seoul, South Korea has led to a public outcry. Opposition lawmakers are calling for the resignation of the current government. Citizens groups are demanding harsh punishment for those responsible. 135 people are known dead from this collapse. Hundreds more are missing. Stock prices closed at a new record today. The Dow gained nearly 49 points to end at 4,664. This is NPR. The women's semifinals produced two tense encounters between the world's four best players. Frank Vardenega has details from Wimbledon.
Steffi Graf is into her seventh Wimbledon final, and she'll be chasing her sixth championship. But her entry into the final was anything but routine, as she was severely challenged by the fourth seed, Jana Novotna. Graf finally advanced, however, 5-7, 6-4, 6-2. And the German top seed will meet Spain's Arantxa Sanchez Vicario, who will be appearing in her first Wimbledon final, following her 6-3, 6-7, 6-1 victory over the defending champion Conchita Martinez. And the attention will now turn to the men's semi-finals. Andre Agassi plays Boris Becker, and Goran Ivanisevic of Croatia will be trying to produce an upset against Pete Sampras. For National Public Radio, I'm Frank Vardenega at Wimbledon.
House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt is offering an alternative to the Republican flat tax and consumption tax plans. The Missouri Democrat wants to cut the top income tax rate to 10% for three-quarters of Americans. Couples who make $40,000 a year or more would have a tax rate ranging from 20 to 34%. Gephardt says Democrats must advance new ideas if they want to thrive in the 1990s. He says that under his system, half of all Americans wouldn't have to file income tax returns at all. The Gephardt plan would eliminate all deductions except for mortgage interest. He would release low-income Americans from the income tax, just as the Republican flat tax plan would. Unlike the GOP plan, Gephardt would continue to tax interest, dividends, and capital gains. The White House says that President Clinton will visit the United Kingdom and Ireland later this year. A spokesman for President Clinton says his visit will be from November 29th through December 1st. Mr. Clinton will see the prime ministers of Britain and Ireland. He will visit Northern Ireland to show his support for the British-Irish peace process. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Lorenzo Carcaterra grew up in New York City's Hell's Kitchen, a poor neighborhood of European immigrants. It was a rough place with a lot of violence in the homes, including Carcaterra's. But in the 1960s, the streets of Hell's Kitchen were safe enough for Carcaterra and his three best friends to run free and make mischief. It was such a safe, enclosed world that despite the violence at home, Carcaterra remembers his childhood as idyllic. But all that changed when in the summer of 1967, one of the boys' harmless pranks went awry, leaving an old man injured near death. Carcaterra and his three friends were sentenced to a year in reform school. Lorenzo Carcaterra has written a book about what happened that year. It's called Sleepers. The names, dates, and places in the story have all been changed to protect those involved. Carcaterra said that though Hell's Kitchen was a training ground for many young criminals, he and his three friends were innocents by comparison, and their pranks playful.
There was this gimmick I could do. I could take a shelf of library books and sort of hook them into hook the center of the, say, 25 books. You can put it in such a way that if you pull the center book out, all 25 would fall. That, I guess, we thought was cute at the time. We released a bag of mice once out of in church, and that really upset the nuns, which, you know, caused great laughter. People, for whatever reason, used to get a kick out of seeing nuns upset. We did that with the clacker. The nuns, I don't know, for those of you not familiar with Catholic school education, nuns use clackers as a way of standing, sitting, depending on how many times they clacked it for the girls that they were in care of. So we got our hands on a clacker, and so we were in church, and the nun would clack it once, and the girls would sit. We'd clack it twice, they'd stand. The nuns would clack it again, they'd sit, and we'd clack it three times, they'd kneel. It was total chaos. So it was that kind of innocent, fun. We would sneak in and try to listen to confessions on Saturday afternoon, which is not, believe me, advocated. But it was a lot of fun.
Well, tell us what happened then. In the summer of 1967, you were setting up a kind of a scam of a hot dog vendor. What happened?
Yeah, it was really, I mean, in hindsight, it was probably the dumbest, stupidest thing we could have done. We had this thing going where if you have a hot dog stand, which, you know, are pretty common in New York City, three of us would hide. One would go up to the hot dog vendor and ask for a hot dog and get it, whatever you want, mustard, onions, the whole bit. And then you run. Now, the vendor is then left with two choices. One, he can chase you, at which point, if he does chase you, the three come in and help themselves and, you know, eat as many hot dogs as they want. Two, he doesn't chase you, in which case you get a free hot dog. In this particular case, the vendor chased me, and my friends helped themselves. And then they got this idea in the back of their head that maybe they could push the cart up a couple of blocks. We were on 10th Avenue. And I don't know for what reason. I have no idea to this day what their intent was. I guess just to move it a few blocks, a few avenues. And I caught up to them a couple of blocks up, and there was nothing else to do. And I think what they decided at the last minute, the ultimate goal of this prank was to hold it above a subway station platform, and have this guy dive for it and catch it at the last minute. Well, you know, in hindsight, obviously that doesn't happen, and the thing fell, and unfortunately an elderly man was coming up, and he was physically harmed, and we were in severe trouble.
Well, the man ended up in a hospital.
He ended up severely injured, almost died from what I understand, and had to live with the remnants of his wounds for the rest of his life.
Well, you and your friends were sentenced to a year at a reformatory in upstate New York. It was called Wilkinson's. What was the reputation of this school?
Well, I changed the names and places and dates in the book to hide the identities of the people involved. We call the place in the book Wilkinson's. It was among the neighborhood, the reputation was that it was a strict place. A lot of people I knew from the area had been up there. But the thing about a neighborhood and the kind of people who grew up in that neighborhood is that you don't talk about these things openly. You don't discuss. You don't say, "Hey, I just spent a year at Wilkinson, and this happened, and this happened, and that happened." You do your time, and it's almost like having been to Vietnam. A lot of the Vietnam veterans that I knew as I got older very seldom spoke about their experiences in Vietnam. So even though I knew there were a number of people in the neighborhood who had been to a home to homes like Wilkinson, no one really said anything about it. So my father was sort of torn. He had this, on the one hand, having been in prison, he knew the negatives and the dangers of it. On the other hand, he had very limited knowledge of juvenile prisons and didn't want to probably scare me too much in the event that nothing did would occur. So he really didn't know how to react. So we really went in here, all four of us, with blinders on. We really didn't know what to expect. We expected, obviously didn't expect to get what we did get, but we went in pretty closed-eyed and thinking, all right, it's going to be a year. We're going to be upstate. How bad could it be?
Well, you write about the savage beatings, the sexual assaults that began really almost immediately once you got to Wilkinson's. And this was all done by guards who worked there. Describe for us, I guess, the kind of control that these guards had over the boys there and over that institution itself.
Well, I don't know about the whole place because, you know, you're in the limited area of a large place. I do know about these four guards in particular who victimized us simply because I think one of the reasons were that what worked for us on the streets of Hell's Kitchen, that we were not these tough kids, we were sort of pranksters, innocent pranksters, worked against us in an institution where innocent pranksters are seen as gullible victims, that you can take advantage of these kids because you're not going to get retribution. We weren't part of a gang. We weren't part of a organized crew from the outside that people could look at. We weren't tough. So I think these four guards in particular who were inclined to take advantage of kids like that, each and every day, whether it was physical, psychological, however, whatever the method was, there was never a moment ever in that 1 year period where you could relax, where the sound of a turning doorknob didn't make you break out into a cold sweat, where you could sleep in a restful sleep, where you could, I mean, that was worse, quite honestly, that is worse than any rape and any sodomy and any of the other things that they, you know, messing with your food and all that stuff. The inability to relax, the inability at an early age to just take a deep breath and say, okay, I'm going to just go to bed now. The inability to be able to think childhood thoughts, the constant fear, the constant tension, the constant nervousness, the constant anxiety is something that you never forget, that you never shake, and that will stay with you till the day you die.
And you feel that some today?
I feel it completely today. I mean, I was telling someone earlier, you know, everyone, I read interviews with authors all the time who write about difficult subjects, who say, oh, it's so therapeutic to write about it and this and that. I found this to be worse than I could ever imagine. I mean, going through the second part of the book, which dealt with the abuse in the juvenile institution, is something that it reawakened it. It was always there. It's always something I deal with. It's something, you know, and it's not anything can quite honestly set it off. A strip of clothing, the way somebody looks at you, the way they comb their hair, how they move, how they don't move, really sets it off. This writing about it has amplified that to a degree, more than talking about it. Writing about it has amplified it to a degree that it's constantly present, and it's present in quick, short flashes. I mean, you'll see a leg in a baton, you'll see a guard's sweaty shirt, you'll see a crying, or you hear a boy cry, and then it goes away. It is always, always present.
Could you, I know you didn't, but could you, in hindsight, ever have reported what was going on a daily basis to someone in authority there?
I guess you could have. You know, I've thought about that. I think you could have. But again, keep in mind, we're coming from an environment, the four of us, where, you know, the quote is, you don't rat anybody out. You don't go to squeal to somebody. A friend of mine visited me. He was about 8 or 9 years older than I was. He was dating a girl in a neighborhood, and he came to visit me a couple of times while I was up there. And he saw me bruised the 2 times he came to see me. And you know, no one in those days thought of child abuse, thought of sexual abuse. He asked me what happened, and I said, well, you know, I got out of line and one of the guards roughed me up. And in our environment, our world, that made perfect sense.
Well, what the guards seemed to do, and there was one in particular you call Sean Noakes, who seemed to be the kind of ringleader, was that they would play off of each of you, off of your fears. They would abuse one of your friends in front of you.
Right.
They would threaten something in front of you. And I guess with your own imagination and knowing, of course, what you were going through, imagining then what your friend was going through.
Yeah, they played their games. I mean, you know, they were very good at what they did. And, you know, the thing, there are a number of things I remember about the character called Sean Noakes. None of them are pleasant. But yeah, he liked to play the mental games much more than the physical. I think he was in many ways less a participant in the physical than he was an instigator of the mental. But it gave him control. I mean, these guys were pretty much from similar backgrounds, from what I understand. They were, you know, high school educated. They were from small towns. You know, they all wanted to be cops, but they couldn't pass the test, so they took this job. And it gave him a sort of muscular control. You used to see it in some neighborhoods. You'll always see the guy who, you know, gets picked on in the neighborhood moves to another neighborhood and starts picking on other kids, all younger kids. I mean, we knew the only thing that was running through my mind, the only positive was that Noakes or any of those other three guys would have survived 1 second in Hell's Kitchen with the crews that were there. I mean,
that was enough to kind of keep you alive,
It kept me going that, you know, this guy, we're here now. We're unprotected and he can take full advantage. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a part in the book after we're worked over that Michael tells him, one of my friends tells him, tells Noakes, you know, kill me now because you can't run the risk of one day knowing or meeting up with us in a place that's not Wilkinson. And I think Michael really believed that. I didn't, quite honestly. I just wanted to get out of there and forget about it. But Michael really believed that somewhere, somehow, down the road, someplace, whether it's going to take 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, he would run into one of these guys or all of these guys again. And again, once we got out of there, the four of us, none of us ever spoke about it. We never discussed it with each other. I never talked about it to anybody. I never talked about it to my father, to my family members. Again, it's not something you discuss. It's not something, you know, if someone did ask, you know, or I never knew who knew in my family or who didn't know. For example, my father kept his word to me, apparently, and told no one that he was related to, that I was up there. We didn't see many family members. People from the neighborhood that knew me knew that I was away, but that was about it. So it was not, once we got out of there, we buried it as deep as we could in our minds. A couple of us moved away. I was sent to Italy for a while, and that helped quite a bit. I went to a great Catholic high school, and that helped enormously. And for a couple of years, I was able to bury it. And I think it's almost like the initial shock is still in there, so you don't deal with it. And you're too young to know how to deal with it.
Were you really able to bury what you had been through? And I'm wondering about things like nightmares or the kinds of emotions that tend to sort of bubble up when you're more unconscious.
No. I have nightmares, quite honestly, to this day. I was under therapy for a number of years, and while that was helpful, again, I find things that bring it to the surface, for me personally, much more difficult to deal with. I think the two characters of John and Tommy, in some way are the lucky ones. They came out of that place. All of us came out with our childhood stripped. Mm-hmm. John and Tommy came out and said, well, okay, they came out with this hard shield, this hard edge to them. Nobody, no one at any point, at any time in their lives was ever going to touch them again. That's the biggest crime to me in this book, is that they took the two sweetest, nicest kids, John and Tommy, who would have done anything. I mean, they're the kinds of kids, if you had just looked at John's eyes, you'd get him an ice cream cone. I mean, he had this black Irish charm. He could do anything. Women as an adult would just melt at his look. Yet they took these two sweet-natured kids and turned them into hardened, vicious, hardened criminals.
They became professional hitmen.
They became criminals. They made their money through crime. Michael and I, again, at a somewhat early age, and again, we had the luxury of parents who took us out of there, out of the neighborhood and put us in, you know, places with trees and birds and things. But we just decided, A, we weren't as tough as even maybe we thought a little bit that we were. And we just certainly didn't want to go back to that place. And maybe the legal way of living is a boring way, is dull, is unexciting, but, you know, it sure beats going up to a place like Wilkinson. So we each went our separate routes. We stayed friends. We kept contact as we grew older and older. And we kept this little secret among us. We never, ever, under any circumstances, discussed it. Even if there was a hint that we were heading that way to bring it up, somebody would quickly change the topic and the subject.
Well, I want to take a short break, and we'll talk some more. I continue this story. And our guest today is Lorenzo Carcaterra. His book is called Sleepers, and it's a story of his own childhood growing up in Hell's Kitchen. He and three of his friends were incarcerated for a prank that got out of control. They ended up in a tough reform school where they were savagely beaten, sexually assaulted, and then years later were able to get some revenge on what happened to them. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Lorenzo Carcaterra. His new book is called Sleepers. Well, to continue this story, it's 1979. You now are young adults, and everyone is out of this reform school. John Riley, Tommy Marcano are, as you said, ruthless or professional killers. They are part of the underworld. They find themselves in a restaurant with Sean Noakes, the man from the reform school that had been the ringleader of the abuse that happened to them there. Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, life works in, as they say, mysterious ways. And for us, events led to two guys being in a room with one guy who shouldn't have been in the room. And the short end of the stick is John and Tommy recognized Sean Noakes much sooner than he recognized them, and did the only thing that they had trained themselves to do. They killed him. They shot and murdered him.
Is there any thought that you have that they had plotted this in any way, or was it truly just a chance occurrence?
No. I think if they plotted it, I'm not aware of it. I doubt very much. You know, I just think it's just someone walks in. I mean, it happens every day. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time. But the nutshell is they walked in on Sean Noakes. They shot and killed Sean Noakes in cold blood. Their arrogance was such that they just walked out, shot the man, and left.
And there were people there. There were witnesses that saw exactly what happened.
Yeah, there were some eyewitnesses. But again, their reputation was so fierce that I really think they believed. I think they believed two things. I think, one, they believed that no one would come forward. And quite honestly, if someone did come forward, they didn't care. I mean, that's how cold they were. They just didn't care. You're going to put me away? Fine. He's dead. I'm glad. That's their attitude.
Well, and then to complicate the story even more, Michael, the third of your friends, the fourth person in this friendship was a district attorney in New York City, and he involved himself in the case. He decided to take it on to prosecute the case.
Right. Michael came to me. We had dinner shortly after John and Tommy were apprehended for this murder. And I had visited both of them. So I was talking to Michael. We would periodically have dinner. I was working as a clerk at the newspaper, at the New York Daily newspaper at the time. So we met at this downtown restaurant, and he said, we had dinner. And he was Michael is not very talkative to begin with, but he was less so that night. And it was a rainy night, and he said, we barely got through the meal, and I wanted a cup of coffee. And he said, take it to go. We got to talk. Mm. And we talked. We walked down the piers, surrounded by hookers and, you know, all that area downtown Manhattan that's sort of our red light district. And in this rain, he lays out this plan for us that he had in the back of his mind. He showed me folders, and he had folders on the three other guards. He had folders on Noakes. He had folders on anything that pertained to the case. And he said, basically, I'm going to go in and ask for this case. And you can take a case under mitigating circumstances. Even though he was an inexperienced attorney, a young attorney, he wasn't totally inexperienced. But the mitigating circumstances, as far as he could see, going into his supervisor, were simply this. He knew the neighborhood. He knew the mentality of the area. He knew the way that people thought and acted, and that he could cull this case together. And in legal parlance, I've been told such a case is called a no-lose. You got two shooters. You got with a vicious reputation. You have eyewitnesses. I mean, even, you know, you and I could try this case.
But didn't the court have any kinds of records that the four of you had been incarcerated together, or that they and you had been incarcerated at the place where Sean Noakes was
no,
a guard?
No, the family court system is such that juvenile records are sealed. Mm-hmm. I believe after a number of years are even destroyed. But regardless whether they're destroyed or not, they're definitely sealed and there's no access to them. So there was no way to worry about that.
And Michael's intention was to lose this case, this no-lose case, in order to get his childhood friends off.
Yeah, to make
for a murder that they did.
Right, right. Which is a murder, in the eyes of the law, is wrong. In our eyes, was not.
What did it take to do that? And I got the feeling, just from the way that you wrote about it, is that you had to get the neighborhood to go along with this, that it was a rather complicated scheme that you had to set up, a kind of more elaborate scam than a lot of the pranks I guess you did
That's
as kids.
Right. Yeah. Well, we were better educated. But no, I think what worked to our advantage, one was it was a small, small case. Two shooters, killing an anonymous guy does not get a lot of press. I mean, we were fortunate in a number of respects. One, the case was very, very small, and it got very, very, you know, in a city of over 2,200 murders, you know, nobody's going to pay attention to a shooting like that. There were only a small group of people who knew about it. You can't trust 50 people on something like this. You have to limit it. In our case, I think it was limited to 6 or 7 people. Fortunately, it was the right 6 or 7. Now, the key to the plan was that we each of us only knew the little bit that Michael allowed us to know. He was the only one that really knew A to Z. I knew, say, H to J. Somebody else knew A to B. Somebody else had C to D. So that's what made it. It was all planned out in his own mind. He had the entire alphabet. We each had a couple of letters. So as long as we stayed to that, even if we were caught, worst case scenario, we get captured and the scheme is, at the time, is brought to light. You know, I get a mild slap on the hand. Michael gets disbarred, which he didn't care about anyway. John and Tommy go to jail, which they were expecting to do. But still, we would then say, the obvious question people would bring up is, why have you done this? And then we would have a response to it. So his plan in that sense was sort of foolproof in that he was ready to go to the mat one way or the other. I mean, to me, he is the hero, or one of the two heroes of the book, in the sense that he gave up everything. He gave up the law. He gave up his life. He sacrificed everything for his friends and for the people he cared about. And I don't think there's a truer definition of a hero than that.
Lorenzo Carcaterra's book is called Sleepers. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air. Lorenzo Carcaterra will be back with us in the second part of the show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Lorenzo Carcaterra. He's just written his second book about growing up in New York City's Hell's Kitchen. His first book was about his relationship with his abusive yet loving father. When Carcaterra was 14, he learned his father had murdered his first wife. And book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Last House, the final book of writing by M.F.K. Fisher.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Federal Reserve has moved to cut interest rates by 0.25%. The central bank governors hope lower rates will stimulate investment and boost the economy. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
It's the first time the Federal Reserve has moved to reduce interest rates in nearly 3 years. The central bank's action brings a key short-term lending rate, called the federal funds rate, down to 5.75%. Commercial banks usually follow suit and reduce some of their rates. The Fed's decision came after yet another government report indicated the economy is weakening. The Commerce Department says its index of leading economic indicators dropped 0.2% in May, the fourth decline in a row. The Fed has been under pressure for months to lower rates in order to encourage borrowing and new investment. But the central bank has been more concerned about inflation and has kept credit tight. Now, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan says inflationary pressures have receded and the economy can withstand an easing of monetary policy. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
A Miami lawyer has been named as independent counsel to investigate the finances of Commerce Secretary Ron Brown. Attorney Daniel Pearson has been selected by a three-judge panel to find if Brown improperly accepted nearly $500,000 from a business partner. Pearson will also check whether Brown falsified financial disclosure statements. Brown's attorney says the Commerce Secretary will come out on top in the probe. Attorney General Janet Reno told reporters today her department has decided not to bring an antitrust case against Ticketmaster. She says the agency believes the ticket agency does have viable competitors. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Ticketmaster is the country's largest distributor of tickets for sporting events and rock concerts. The rock group Pearl Jam has charged that Ticketmaster has a monopoly on that market and uses the advantage to set prices too high for the average teenager to pay. After looking at the matter, Attorney General Janet Reno says the Justice Department's antitrust division believes the competition is developing.
I think their concern was that there is a great deal of activity in this arena. There are new enterprises coming into the arena, and it did not seem an appropriate time to continue to pursue the investigation.
Pearl Jam says the Justice Department has caved in to Ticketmaster and pledged not to use the agency for its tours. Ticketmaster still faces an investigation by New York State's Attorney General. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Japan's auto imports have surged 35% in the first half of this year. The Japan Automobile Importers Association says import sales for the first half of the year were nearly 186,000 cars, but that is in a total market of more than 2.5 million sales. On Wall Street, the Dow continues to respond to the Federal Reserve action. The Dow has jumped 48 points to 4,663. Trading is very heavy. This is NPR. Several top Italian fashion designers have been indicted by an Italian court on charges of corruption. NPR's Silvio Pujoli reports from Rome.
Giorgio Armani, Gianfranco Ferré, Crizia, and the brother of Gianni Versace are charged with paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to tax inspectors in exchange for lenient audits. The trial, slated to begin in September, will certainly be the most glamorous in the 3 years since Milan investigators began their crusade against corruption. Up to now, most of the 2,000 people investigated have been politicians and businessmen. Italian fashion is one of Italy's most important export industries, bringing in $24 billion a year, and its best designers have been elevated to the status of celebrities. When the investigation began 9 months ago, all the designers admitted making the payments, but said they had been extorted by greedy tax officials. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
St. Louis area hospitals say they've treated 102 Grateful Dead fans injured in a porch collapse. Hospitals say 10 people were treated and admitted. Two of them are critically injured. Officials say the fans ran to a campground porch to get out of a downpour. It collapsed under their weight. Authorities say some people were dancing on the porch when it came in. About 4,000 Dead fans are at the Pine Woods campground. The Dead have another show scheduled for tonight.
The government is now urging pregnant women to undergo counseling and voluntary testing for the virus that causes AIDS. This is a reversal by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC had initially recommended testing for high-risk women only. This change comes on overwhelming evidence that AZT treatments can protect newborns from the disease. A federal study finds if infected women take AZT during pregnancy, they can cut chances of transmitting the disease to the fetus. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're back with Lorenzo Carcaterra, author of the new book Sleepers. When Carcaterra was 12, a harmless childhood prank that went horribly wrong landed him and his three best friends in a reformatory in upstate New York. There, they were subjected to daily torment at the hands of four guards who took sadistic delight in physically, sexually, and emotionally abusing them. They survived their year in reform school but went home scarred, embittered, and changed. Two of the boys, Johnny and Tommy, grew to be professional criminals. Michael became a district attorney in New York City, and Carcaterra embarked on a career as a writer. By chance, in 1979, John and Tommy found themselves in the same place as their former abuser. They killed him and were arrested. Michael convinced the DA's office to let him prosecute the case, hiding his connection to the victim and the accused. He lost the case on purpose, getting his friends off. To pull this off, Michael had to get the whole neighborhood to go along with his false case, including the local priest, Father Bobby, a favorite with the kids because, in many ways, he was just like them.
There's a lot about him that's a mystery, you know, because he's very secretive about certain things. I knew from other people that he himself was a juvenile years earlier. He's a tough guy. He was a fighter. He was much tougher than we were. What we loved about him is we pulled scams on every teacher we had. But with him, you had to be very careful because any scam we could even remotely think of, he had done. But, you know, when he took us, for example, we used to go on excursions as children to Rye Beach. He knew the scam to do at Rye Beach is you rent the rowboat, you sneak into another school group, somebody, say St. Barnabas' school or whatever. You then go in their rowboat and you dig a little hole in their rowboat and watch them sink. I mean, so he knew that. And
he'd done it all.
Well, yeah, when we got on the bus, he looked for the guy with the corkscrew.
Well, what did it take to get Father Bobby to lie on the stand, which is what he did?
Right. He doesn't consider it, nor do I consider it a lie. I mean, you know, the Catholic Church has this philosophy, which I buy totally into, is that you punish the sin, not the sinner. And I think he looked at it. We gave him, you know, I laid it out for him. And I left it the way our relationship has been and the way my relationship has been with all my friends who are still remaining, the few that are there for 30 years, is that there's such trust between us that I said to him, if you do this, you don't do this, nothing changes. We still are what we are. But I trusted him to know everything that went on. And I laid it out for him one night in his little apartment, little room. He lit a cigarette and he said, all right, I got something, you know, I got a decision to make. And he made what he felt was a truthful decision. He does not feel in his mind, yes, you look up the definition of lie, yes, he lied. In the overall scheme of the world, did he do a better good than not? I think he did.
And what he said was that John and Tommy were with him.
At a basketball game. Where else would they be? Father Bobby plays basketball 2 hours a day. We had ticket stubs, which are not hard to come by in that neighborhood at that time. If you're from Hell's Kitchen and the garden was a place, again, even though it had moved to its current location, a number of people from the neighborhood still work there. Again, I don't know the specifics of how he got the stubs, who gave him the stubs or whatever the scheme they came up with. But he took the stand and put John and Tommy at a place other than where they were the night of the shooting, which came as much of a shock to John and Tommy as it did to anybody else.
Which was enough to get them off.
Yeah, there are some attorneys have read the book and have eliminated Father Bobby from the case, and they still think Michael would have lost. It's a lot like the O.J. Simpson. Someone compared it to the O.J. Simpson trial that of the four witnesses that existed, two backed down. And one testified, and she was shaky. They found she drank a little too much. So you have a shaky witness. They couldn't find a murder weapon, and they couldn't find a motive.
Well, let me ask you, does this book in any way incriminate you or others who conspired to get these two men off?
No, I don't think we did anything legally wrong. Personally, all I did was shuffle some papers. I don't even know what was in them. I moved them from step A to step B. And I guess the only person I would imagine, I'm not an attorney, so I know that the only person that could, I mean, Michael, I guess they could go after, but, you know, he's not practiced. That was his last case or one of his last cases. He never cared to practice anymore. So, you know, if they did find his true identity, which I hope they don't, but if they did find it, I guess, you know, they would disbar him or whatever you do to a lawyer, penalize him. Father Bobby, I think if, you know, the church found out which clergyman it was, would probably get whatever retribution, but within the confines of the Catholic Church.
But aren't there records of this trial? And I don't mean to be too nitpicky here, but I'm just trying to paper trail might be.
Well, the paper trail was taken care of by Michael. I saw documents both by Michael and by a police officer, a high-ranking officer, who helped me piece through the case and helped me choose what to disguise, what to move, change of venue, change of scenery, change of dates, how to alter everything but still stay to the truth of the story. Then the documents were given back, and what was done with them, I don't know.
Hmm. John Riley and Tommy Marcano got off for this crime, but they ended up dead. What happened to them?
Well, what happened to them was something that we talked about. We did talk about that, you know, they chose a certain life for themselves, and they knew it was a life that would end with a bullet. But it's better than a life of that they had known it at the institution. Nobody was going to come after them. They knew it was a short life. It would end very violently, but it would end on their own terms. And quite honestly, I really believe that they're the fortunate ones in my story, that they are indeed dead.
More fortunate than you?
Yeah, more fortunate than me, more fortunate than Michael, certainly, because it ends for them. It, the moment they died, it ended. For Michael and myself, in various degrees, it will never end. I mean, this book will come and go, and, you know, you'll read it, not read it, you'll like it, not like it. The memories will stay with me forever until the day I die. The physical problems we have, I mean, are worse than scars, quite honestly, are very nightmarish, and the nightmares, the nighttime still bothers me. You know, I feel very uncomfortable in among people and in groups. Michael feels so much so that he's isolated his entire life for years. And has lived in foreign lands because the whole experience not only made him distrustful of the system, of other people, made him really distrustful of his very own place where he grew up and lived, his own country.
You mentioned the fact that you have physical problems related to what happened to you. What kinds of physical problems are you talking about?
Well, I have severe back pains and leg pains that are just, you know, you go to about 40 different doctors and there's nothing you can do about it. I have an inner ear imbalance that I'm trying currently under physical therapy to straighten out, that it's hard for me to stay steady for a long period of time. And again, the therapists have all said that's related to my childhood beatings. Physically, on paper, I'm healthy. But you look at except for the inner ear, there's definitely damage done to the inner ear. There's damage to the back. There's damage to the neck area. So other than that, I'm healthy. Mentally, it's made it, you know, all those problems are, those physical problems are fed by the mental thoughts that go through your mind. So a pinch in the arm to you, maybe just, you know, a mild irritation. To me, it's like, you know, a baton swing.
My guest is Lorenzo Carcaterra, author of Sleepers. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Lorenzo Carcaterra, author of Sleepers, a story of four friends growing up in Hell's Kitchen and the brutal year they spent in a reformatory that changed their lives. At the end of the story, you have kind of encapsulated what happened to the kind of cast of characters. How hard was it for you to track down what happened to some of these guards or some of the other players in this particular story?
Again, it was only as hard as reaching out. I mean, I'm fortunate that I come from an area and I spent most of my life with cops or criminals. And if you spend your life with cops or criminals, that you covered everything. You covered A and B. And so if you can't find it from a criminal, you'll find it from a cop. If you can't find it from a cop, you find it from a criminal. I'm not a great reporter by any means. I just had friends and people who would, in cop terminology, reach out and get me information and were kind enough to give it to me. And then all I had to simply do was alter dates, change names, change places and all that stuff. But I had the basic stuff. You know, somebody would call and say, so-and-so died this way, for example. And I'd say, okay, I knew then how he really died. And then I just would make him dead, but make him dead in a different place, in a different time, and a different locale.
Your first book, A Safe Place, was about your father and your relationship with him and the fact that he murdered his first wife. Your second book, Sleepers, is also about your family, your childhood.
Right.
Are you going to write more about your family?
No, this is it. We're going to bury Lorenzo now.
Is that right?
Yeah. I think next one's going to be fun, I hope. But it's definitely not me. What more could happen? I mean, you know, it was a pretty packed 20-something years. I wrote a first book about my father, and I dealt with that. And I wrote a second book about my friends, and I dealt with that. And now I think it's time to, write about something else.
It seems in certain ways that your family helped you through this difficult chapter in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's another whole story, another whole side of the family that you came from, the fact that your father killed his first wife.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see those two stories of your family connected?
That the violence and the help at the same time?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's typical for the first book, I talked to a lot of people who either were children of a parent who had killed somebody or were on the receiving end and had a parent murdered. And I think, again, they're all from the same lower working class environment. And, you know, they're there for you. To give you a terrific example, I think, my father's family obviously was quite upset with me for the first book. And, you know, from their end, rightfully so. You're writing about something that's 40, 50 years old, and why bring it up? Who cares about it other than the family? That's the mentality. Nobody outside the family should know. Yet at the same time, with this book, they're very defensive of me. So it's that old mentality, hey, you can call Lorenzo a bum. I can call him a bum because he's my Lorenzo. You don't know him, so stay out of it. So I think my father came to, we had a really rough and tumble. The first 14 years of my life, he was one of my best friends along with the three guys from the streets. And then, you know, I found out what had happened, and it sort of soured the relationship for a number of years until he was dying, and then we reunited again. So the first book was about that, was about my relationship with my father, which was as complicated, I guess, as any father-son relationship gets.
Well, as you say, he was one of your best friends, and yet he was responsible for 35 stitches on your body.
Yeah, well, that's not uncommon in poor neighborhoods. I mean, he was a man of the moment. He was a man of action. He was... you know, he responded violently because it was the only way he knew how to respond to situations. And it was done, you know, some of it was done because I was blocking my mother and, you know, preventing her from getting hurt. Others were done simply because, you know, I mean, especially the Wilkinson period, I mean, frightened him that I could run with a bad crowd. And that was, he had always said to me, he said, I'm going to give you a choice. If I'm given the choice of a drug-addicted son or a dead son, I will take the dead son.
Hmm.
And, you know, and I believe them. To this day, I mean, I was always convinced, you know, when you're in your 20s and you go to these parties and there's cocaine out and there's all that stuff, and, you know, like anybody else, you're really tempted to try it. I was convinced the minute I went near it, like some closet door would open and he'd come flying out and beating the hell out of me. So it kept me, I never even tried the mildest form of drug, I mean, other than the drugs they give me to numb the back pain. But I think he, in his own way, he was a great father. And I, you know, despite the beatings, despite the abuse, I regret now, quite honestly, that he's, when I wrote that first book, I grew to really miss him. It brought closure to him with me. And he was a buddy. You know, it's tough for people to understand who are not from that kind of violent world. But, you know, he would have never, He would always have been there for me, regardless of the circumstance, regardless of the situation. I mean, if he were alive today, I would defy anybody who questioned the validity of my book. He'd be in their face in about 5 seconds, physically in their face, which is, you know, not a pleasant sight.
Well, you were incarcerated just before your 13th birthday, left out, got out 1 year later, and it was at the age of 14 that you found out what your father had done with his first wife, and you found out from your mother.
Yeah, it was a tough couple of years, to put it mildly, but, you know, everybody has hardships in their life. I'm sure there are things in your life that have been very difficult for you to get through, and somehow you wade through them. You don't like to do it. You don't like to have to go through it, you know. I'm always amazed, you know, friends of mine who, you know, have been in therapy for 25, 30 years for the most minuscule things, you know, like their father never talked to them, you know, or didn't talk to them enough at dinner. I never had that. My father, he was always there. And, you know, I just had to deal with the fact that he killed somebody. And I had to deal with it from the point of view, A, how he could have done it, how he could live with it. And was I capable of doing the same thing? That was one of the things that torment. I mean, I have a lot of torments in my mind. I'm obviously a troubled person, I guess. But that goes through your mind, as well as what happened to you while you were away for the year, and what happened to you with your friends. So I think I put about 100 years of life in the first 20 something years of my own life. So this boring phase that I'm in is kind of refreshing. It puts people asleep when they hear what I do during the day. But for me, it's, you know, it gives me time to sort things out. And it may take, you know, it doesn't take just two books to sort it out. It takes a lifetime to sort out these emotional conflicts I've faced. I don't think I'll ever come to terms with my own past as what's described in Sleepers.
Hmm. Well, Lorenzo Carcaterra, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and talking about your latest book.
Thank you.
Lorenzo Carcaterra's book is called Sleepers. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us now to tell us about All Things Considered. Noah, do you have any financial news coming out of the nation's capital?
Hi, Marty. You bet. The Federal Reserve Board has cut one of the important short-term interest rates by 0.25%. Other stories, Edward Lifson has a report on the large number of bank robberies in Chicago. My colleague Linda Wertheimer talks with Congressman Richard Gephardt about an income tax idea, a flat tax of 10% to be filed, he says, on a postcard. Also, President Clinton speaks at Georgetown University today with campaign-sounding themes here in Washington. And I'll talk with the state park director in South Dakota about the idea of putting Mount Rushmore under state control. Also, music from North by Northwest.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When MFK Fisher died in 1992, she left enough unpublished essays, letters, and journal entries to fill three posthumously published books. The first two books in the trilogy, To Begin Again and Stay Me, Oh Comfort Me, revisited Fisher's childhood and her early years as a writer and wife in France. The final volume, entitled Last House, has just been published, and it traces Fisher's life into the 1980s. When she battled Parkinson's disease, arthritis, and cataracts to keep writing. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review of Last House and some thoughts on Fisher's legacy.
In the summer of 1927, the 19-year-old MFK Fisher wrote in her diary, "I'm just a mumbler in life." With the exception of a few more late adolescent moans, this diary entry surely must have been the last false thing MFK Fisher ever wrote. When she died at the age of 83, most of the obituaries quoted W.H. Auden, who once called Fisher America's greatest writer. In over 25 books of essays and memoirs, Fisher wondered aloud about the basic human hungers for food, sex, companionship, art, travel, and transcendence. She was anything but a mumbler. Even with her mouth full of truffle pâté, she spoke with passionate clarity. But occasionally, Fisher did murmur. Her voice would soften when she spoke of the breakup of her first marriage and the tragic death of her second husband, the painter Dilwyn Parrish. Fisher refused to edit out life's viler episodes from her autobiographical writing, a decision that safeguarded those pieces from lazy nostalgia And so it's fitting that Last House, her final collection, should confront one of the nastiest subjects of all, old age. The book opens with a couple of raw essays from the 1950s in which a youngish Fisher confesses to the loathing she sometimes feels for her own senile father. Fisher writes, "Rubbing his feet, I could feel my hatred flow like bile through my fingertips into his strangely warm, knobby, venous toes, ankles, and calves." But in the blink of an eye, the dutiful daughter becomes an old woman herself. In a 1981 essay entitled Frustration, Fisher announces, "I really am very ready to stop going through the increasingly difficult motions of being an upright human person. I do not want to eat or drink ever again." Other sketches describe Fisher's bowel movements, vomiting habits, and the bad drugged sleep she suffered in hospitals. The intense scrutiny Fisher once trained on food and other people is turned inward here on her own crumbling body. Last House is not in the running to become one of my favorite MFK Fisher collections. She herself used the quaint term glory hole to characterize the book, meaning a Fibber McGee-type closet where you cram all sorts of stuff. Some of these cast-offs turn out to be salvageable. There's a moving reflection on her undiminished sexual yearning for Dilwyn Parrish. There's also an essay that begins, "I am thinking now about some of the best meals in my life." To Fisher lovers, it's worth the price of this book just to find out how she follows up that tantalizing sentence. But many of these pieces read like entries from a writer's diary, quick attempts to capture images that were never developed into insights. And okay, I'll own up to being shallow. I'd rather read Fisher's shimmering descriptions of the fish markets of Marseille than her complaints about hip surgery. The year before she died, Fisher was interviewed by Bill Moyers, who asked her if she had done everything she wanted to do in life. "I never did enough," she replied, "never enough." Last House may be an uneven collection, but knowing that it's the last new book we'll ever have by MFK Fisher, I keep thinking of her reply to Moyers, "Never enough, never enough."
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Last House by MFK Fisher. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harmony Books, publisher of The Return of Merlin, a new novel from Deepak Chopra. This is NPR, National Public Radio.